उमज्ञानतिमिदंदस्य अज्ञानं जनशलाकय चाक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। नाम सृष्टं मनुमाभिसच्चिपुत्रं मत्रास्वरूपं रूपं तस्याग्रजमुरुपुरीं मथुरीं गुष्टावतीं राधाकुन्दं गिरिवरं महोराधिकमधावसम् प्रप्तयस्य प्रतीत्तगृपाया श्रीगुरुं तं नतोऽस्मि। वंशकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासन्धुभ्यैव च तीतानं पवानेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। निखिलाश्रुतिमौलिरत्नमालदिति निराजिता पदपङ्कजन्त आजमुक्तकुलायरूपश्यामनं परितस्तं हरिणं संश्रयामि। वन्दे श्रीकृष्णचैतन्यनित्यानन्दसहोदितं गोददाय पुष्पवन्तचित्रसंहृतमोऽनुदम्। हे कृष्णकरुणासिन्धु दीनबन्धुजगत्पते गोपेशगोपीककान्त राधाकान्त नमोऽस्तुते। राधिवृन्दवनादि श्रीकरुणामृतवाहिनि कृपया निजपादब्जादस्यन्मह्यं प्रदीयतम्। भक्त्या विहीनायपराधलक्षये क्षिप्तशाघमादितरङ्गमाध्ये कृपां मयि त्वं शरणं प्रपानं वृन्देन्मस्ते चरणारविन्दम्। वृन्देन्मस्ते चरणारविन्दम्। श्री सचिनंदन गौर हरि की जय। श्री हरिनाम प्रभु की जय। समवेद भक्त वृंद की जय। गौर प्रमानंद हरि हरि वो प्रणाम ऑल ऑफ यू वेलकम। आई एम सो ग्लैड टू बी हियर बैक आफ्टर टू वीक्स व्हिच फेल लाइक a few ages or so, at least subjectively for me, probably considering the dynamics of the last few days. I'm sending you my greetings from Massachusetts, more specifically Boston, more specifically the Harvard area. As you may know, I have started this Hindu monastic program last week, already 1 week in Harvard. So far, so good, still alive. I plan to record some short video and probably put it in my YouTube channel, not probably, shortly, maybe on Monday. So I'll describe a little bit more in detail how it was my first week in Harvard, landing in the new planetary system, at least for me, called Harvard, with all the lessons and all the challenges and all the beauty of it, beauty and messiness of the Swami's journey in Harvard. So I won't enter into the details now, but I will be sharing that video in a few days, and I'll try to share as many updates as I can. Maybe it may not be possible for it to be weekly, as classes are starting in a few days. This first week was more like an orientation program, intensive, but classes are starting from Wednesday. So let's see how much I can navigate the work overload and study and reading and a weekly sharing of report over here, but I will do my best. And of course, we'll be still seeing each other every weekend, as usual. So you are all more than welcome to our weekly satsang, our weekly encounter. We come here for encounter. As recently the other day, someone said in one of the orientation lectures, and I may be a little bit referencing to a few of those experiences from these days without even thinking about it, but I appreciated that one of the teachers said, this is a place for encounter and learning. So we come here with that willingness. We show up to this space, to this satsang, with that willingness. That's basically the meaning of satsang, no? Learning the truth, encountering the truth, being encountered with the truth. And the truth doesn't necessarily mean what I think it's the truth, what I've learned so far is the truth, what I experienced so far is the truth. but many times with new perspectives of the truth, divergent opinions that invite for a pluralistic, accommodating capacity and holding of space. Now we have to develop, as I like to say, our hosting capacity without, of course, accepting anything and everything and without betraying ourselves nor our ideals. But at the same time, because we don't want to betray our ideals and ourselves, we want to be, we want to develop our hosting capacity as much as that is healthy for us, for others, as much as that's sustainable, as much as that is not a superficial imposition from the environment, from others, from ourselves, that is not a healthy thing to do. But there is always a healthy thing to do in terms of exposing ourselves to new perspectives. So this is basically what we are here about, not necessarily to have our beliefs reassured, to have our assumptions absolutized, to have the Swami confirming all my prejudices, so to say. Sometimes some of those may need to be challenged. Sometimes we may, of course, hopefully we feel also reassurance in what needs to be reassured, belonging and a strengthening of the faith. But many times all that happens also by a healthy, necessary dose of uncertainty, of doubt, of a new holy shift appearing into the picture that somehow unsettles our convictions and invites us to have a little bit more of humility in terms of approaching reality. And again, I'm not saying this to any of you in particular. I'm saying that to me in particular to begin with. And for some of you, this resonates. Welcome, because this is what we are all about it here. Mm-hmm. And in that spirit, we invite each of you to bring questions, quests, explorations, topics, things you feel the need to go deeper into, to clarify something that may be a creative tension that you are struggling with, some hot seat that you are sitting on, and you may want to leave, and you may not need to leave yet. We'll see. Whatever is required to be shared, you are welcome to do so. Hopefully we can all together craft some spaciousness and safety for each one of us to find belonging, purpose, identity, again, with the necessary dose of effort and challenge that is necessary for find belonging, purpose, and identity, which do not come in autopilot. So there are a few digital hands raised, and of course, each one of you is invited to raise your digital hands if you have anything. If you don't know how to do that, you can send a text message in the chat. I'll try to be as attentive as I can to that. And we'll honor and respect throughout the meeting the order of the in which the hands were raised digitally. So I'm keeping track of that now, because after going to the breakout rooms, those hands will disappear, will dissolve into the ether, but we'll keep track of them. So we invite first Silpa Karini to unmute herself, bring her offering. Welcome.
Nakum Hal Krishna Maharaj. I have a question. I'm reading your book, Radical Personalism, and there it stated that Gaudiya Vaishnava thing, you know, is in, you said it's in the baby shoes, you know, coming to the West, it's like not really old, right? And if I got it right, I understood, like, I don't know if I got it right, but so I understood, or you wrote something like there's, so it's so early and there's time to improve so much more, right? And then I was thinking Christianity is on the planet like for such a long time, and it actually got worse over time. It didn't improve, it actually got worse. So I was thinking maybe that could happen with, you know, Hare Krishna, Gaudiya Vaishnava too, because over time many things get changed or changed and get lost, like in Christianity, right? That was my thought.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. So So you are referring to this section on radical personalism where I refer to the Gaudiya Sampradaya, the Kumar Lila of the Gaudiya Sampradaya, or the childhood pastimes of the Gaudiya Sampradaya. But this, of course, I always try to clarify because I remember some people took it a little bit like that I'm criticizing the tradition, or I'm saying that the tradition in its essence is it's in its infancy. But that was not the point. I appreciate that you got the point that actually we are talking in terms of the years on earth in which the tradition has been present, at least to our knowledge. It doesn't mean that what we are about has just a few hundred years and before that, that didn't exist. We are talking about how the eternal truth, the ever all existent truth, manifests in different forms, at different places, at different times. But that doesn't mean that that was the beginning of the whole thing. It's the beginning in a certain particular place, time, and circumstance. As I always like to say, okay, Mahaprabhu appeared 500 years ago, a little bit more than that. That doesn't mean that Gaur Lila, Nityanavadvip did not exist before that. Maybe many of us didn't know about it, but that doesn't mean that doesn't exist. There are so many things we ignore. And our ignorance is not proof of their non-existence, right? It will be pretty, how to say, bold and bordering narcissism to say, if I do not know about something, that thing does not exist. It's like, wow, no? Because most of the things we do not know most of the thing. I mean, in comparison to what we know, there are way more things that we do not know, which doesn't mean they do not exist. They do not exist on our radar. And we shouldn't overestimate our radar, right? And take our knowing capacities too seriously. So yeah, that chapter is speaking about the unfolding, the historical unfolding of a tradition, and a tradition which is relatively new, even thinking in terms of its official beginnings in connection to Mahaprabhu and the tradition in India. Of course, it's tied to elder Vaishnava traditions, and we can connect that with the Vedas in many ways, and that goes back for thousands of years. And we will say that beyond that, these realities exist eternally again, and they are manifest on our particular plane, a certain time, place, and circumstance. But not only Gaudiya Vaishnavism is a few hundred years old, if you want to think more in terms of its reach to the West, Western world, that's even younger. So, in that sense, not as a critique, just as a as an observation that I think we need to acknowledge, not to take, not only not to take ourselves too seriously, but also to be self-compassionate and self-understanding in terms of witnessing the unfolding of a movement and understanding you cannot expect everything to be perfectly in place immediately or ever. And there are different dynamics, of course, right? Something may start in a very, as you pointed, no, something may start in a very deep, ecstatic, non-institutional way, mystic, and eventually it may get a little bit boxed, put into boxes, institutionalized, and starting to flirt with empire and power dynamics, and the deep ideals of the tradition do become compromised, at least in the lives of those who practice, some of them. So those things happen, every tradition, nothing new. In one sense, it has nothing to do with the core values of the school, of any of these schools. It's just how we humans digest religion, so to say, and start to mix it with personal agenda and social dynamics and political influence and so on and so forth. So now you refer to Christianity. You made a parallel, or not a parallel, a connection to Christianity in terms of, well, in time Christianity got worse. I will say yes and no. As usual, I will try to take in, I feel the need to take a nuanced stance because it's not, it all got wrong, it all got worse, it all got better. Things never are that way. Now, even when we are talking about Kali Yuga, so I like to speak about Kali Yuga. And to begin with, and I'm returning to Christianity in a moment, but as another example, first of all, some Gaudiya Vaishnavas do not agree that we are in Kali Yuga yet, and they will make the case, and that's based on the Bhagavatam, and that we are on a sandhi or a transition period from Dwapara Yuga to Kali Yuga. That's another conversation. Even if we were to accept we're in Kali Yuga, I would not agree that in every sense of the term, every single department of existence is getting worse and worse in comparison to previous decades, centuries, ages. Of course, there are things that are getting worse and worse, but not necessarily all. So I think it's important to hold this capacity to appreciate both things happening at the same time. Some things may, there's a trajectory of degradation that continues to unfold, hitting deeper rock bottoms, and a trajectory of enlightenment and inspiration and currents of revelation continues to unfold, touching higher and higher regions of the sky, if you will. So the same, going back to Christianity, I will say the same with Christianity. There are, of course, necessarily things that got worse, institutionally, religiously, politically, socially, abuse, power dynamics, hierarchy, dogma, fanaticism, empire, conquest, and whatnot. I mean, list is long, and I'm not here to stigmatize Christianity. At the same time, I will say that even, I won't say because of that, like saying that's the cause of something better coming out of it, but many times because of that negative impetus happening in the name of Christianity, a lot of wonderful counter movements in the context of Christianity came as well to make sure that, to learn from the past, so to say, to learn from previous mistakes. And that's an ongoing journey. Again, it's not about Christianity, it's about our lives. That's how we learn, as Father Richard Rohr will say. And with someone like Father Richard Rohr will say, with someone like him on earth, I would not agree that Christianity got worse. Now, people like him or many others, I'm not limiting that to Father Richard, but our testament that a particular tradition continues to evolve and grow and get deeper and more loving and more mature and more so many things. Without them, there is no end to that. But you may find that in particulars, in individuals, if we expect that to be fully exhibited by the mainstream institution, that may not be the case ever, because mainstream institutions have another rhythm, so to say, and even another role, and tend to get corrupted and tend to get compromised. Yes. So again, I will try to nuance the idea of in time Christianity got worse. Yes, in some aspects, in some cases. No, in some other aspects, in some other cases. We need to be radically personal, since we are based our conversation on my book, Radical Personalism. But again, even if we want to touch upon some of the things that got worse, or some cases, particular cases, we could say that got worse. Yes, of course, I'm completely open to the possibility that that may happen also with Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Again, it's not like this is the exclusive domain of Christianity to get worse in some things at some times in time. That can happen again. Let's normalize those dynamics, not to promote them, but those things can happen, and those things have happened, and those things are happening in our Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition. I mean, there are many, in my opinion, many deep misunderstandings in how the tradition is conceived and represented in certain cases. Again, I'm not pointing to one group. I'm pointing to certain ways of misrepresentation that may happen in a group or may happen in an individual that to me are a betrayal to the original message, to the original cause. I don't know, just to throw one theme and, like, for example, women are ontologically inferior, therefore they cannot be gurus. If they are qualified, they did blah, 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 things like that. Or still many currents of strong emphasis on caste and being born in a certain group, and that gives you more rights, which have nothing to do with Mahaprabhu's movement. We have talked so many times how Mahaprabhu wasn't, so we were talking the other day with Bhaktiras, and this topic iconoclast came. An iconoclast generally is someone who is known as an idol breaker, but generally is taken as someone who don't like deities, basically. So they destroy them. And we have these various cases of different conquerors traveling and destroying deities or destroying this. That's an iconoclast. But also an iconoclast can be a form breaker or an idol breaker in the terms of if you are engaging in idolatry, genuine idolatry, and it's not necessarily a card form. It can be a way of thinking. It can be a system. Okay, now iconoclasts will destroy that by their example and way of thinking for our betterment, right? So again, Mahaprabhu was one of such people, and many of our Guru Bharga, if not all, they always have to break certain ways of idolatry that were prevalent at their time. And the next generation, there will be another way of idolatry that needs to be dismantled. And the prophets, the iconoclasts, the mystics, if you will be the ones doing that with the whatever price they may need to pay. And Mahaprabhu was one of those. So yeah, every genuine tradition starts with that spirit. And after generations happen, you don't need to even wait for a long time. Misunderstanding come, even speaking about Christianity. I mean, the very followers of Jesus, many of them did not understand many of the things he said, and that's registered in the Bible. It doesn't mean that eventually they didn't get a better understanding, but my point is there's always some confusion around who is the founder of the line, which are our values, and how to represent them. There will be always not only some confusion, there will be always different opinions. And that's how you have eventually multiple lineages emerging from any given tradition. And not necessarily all of them are deviations from the original, only one way to do things style. So it's important also to give space for that. So Gaudiya Vaishnava SMBA is in its baby steps, social historically. Started from a very moving place, as I like to say. Mahaprabhu's movement is started with Mahaprabhu's own heart being moved in a very unique way, then taking his own body to move and dance and celebrate. And those who witnessed that were moved themselves, became melted by witnessing his melted heart. They started to move internally, they started to move externally, and eventually bricks and walls and papers came, and then we have a movement in a more hard way, in a more rigid way, which is not something bad. The point is how much that is facilitating the external movement, how much the external movement is facilitating the internal movement. And yeah, there will always be something, getting worse, going back to your expression, but we can always do something about it. And that's the commitment of each one of us. I mean, we are all, that's an important but very simple point, but very often misunderstood or not fully embraced. That is, each of you have the responsibility to correct what is a deviation in your tradition. Each of you should feel empowered enough to denounce abuse, to denounce compromising, to denounce whatever is nonsense in the name of the values of the tradition we subscribe to. That's what it means to be a committed member of it. I don't need a letter of approval or someone putting their hands on my head to have a voice of my own. No. Of course, first you need to have some education and understanding so the voice of your own doesn't contribute to the problem. So that's also a point. But I think that's important so we don't become just like cynical critics or cynical observers. Oh, things are going worse. There are things that are getting worse. If I really love my tradition, and that's part of I think that's the first chapter of my book, like I criticize my tradition because I love it, right? So because I love you, I may dare attempt to tell you some things that will not be so flattering, so comfortable. Because I love you and I want the best for you. And I'm willing to be told the same things myself. If I trust that you really love me, okay, some observations may come. And if they are true, which they may be or may not be, that doesn't mean that if I open myself for feedback, whatever someone will tell me, I have to accept that as true. That's not the case. But at least there has to be the openness and the willingness to listen to each other, to participate, and to as much as we can see and think and feel, try to make a contribution to make things better, to bring more peace, more harmony, more love, more introspection, more critical thinking, so many things that you can never bring enough of those. So a few thoughts, Silva Carini. I don't know if somehow that addresses your
Yes, inquiry. That's fine, that's great. I just quickly bring in, I thought always to be in the beginning of a movement, like when I was thinking of Christianity, you know, the early Christians, they were so lucky because it was all unchanged and original. And I thought that's also, you know, in the Gaudiya Vaishnava, it's more Hare Krishna, you know, maybe we are so lucky to be there in the beginning because it's so new and so fresh and how it's supposed to be. But maybe it doesn't matter so much, actually.
As long as you feel that you are so lucky, that's important. And as long as we don't become trapped with thinking that there is only one correct way of practicing Christianity or practicing our tradition, Bhakti tradition, because there is not only one way. Doesn't mean that anything goes, but also doesn't mean that only one thing goes, because that can be the beginning of one of the big problems that most of the traditions have, which is fundamentalism. This is the one and only way. Not only this is the one and only religion, but then on top of that, this is the one and only way to practice the one and only religion. And I happen to be part of that. Therefore, my mission on earth is to make everyone else know about how wrong they are and how correct they should be. And that can make for a complicated recipe, to say the least. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Let's go for a few minutes to our breakout rooms to continue churning together. Based on what we just shared, what has touched you, some reflections, something that you feel was important for you that needs to be unpacked, shared in intimate sangha and intimate circles. So encourage you to be part of it for a few minutes, and we'll return for the next exploration soon. Welcome back. I wish you have some fruitful 5 minutes of condensed, thick sharing and presence to each other. Before moving to the next question, so if anyone has something you would like to share that is publicly shareable, some of the touchstones, some of the treasures that came from your sharing, no need to hold your hand, but you can just activate your microphone if there is anything that you feel couldn't reach us all.
I will say something in our little group, if you don't mind.
Yes.
That how excited we are to know that, because it was predicted, Mahaprabhu's appearance is creating a period of awakening and enlightenment, and others are feeling it too. They don't know why exactly, perhaps. This is my own thinking and what we were saying. Mm. But it's happening, you know, the planet is a very exciting place to be now from different perspectives and dimensions. And because of the awakening and the re-spiritualization coming back to respect of the earth. And I heard this morning, and we know this from our tradition, that the spirits are waiting in line to come here because it is a very exciting time to be on the planet. And we know that from Prabhupada. I mean, he said it 50 years ago, that people wait online to come and take birth here. It's a very auspicious thing to be doing. Mm. So we had a great conversation. Thank you.
Jai Mahaprabhu. Of course, I'd like to add 2 footnotes to that, just to, from my perspective, the need to add 2 footnotes. One is, of course, we agree with all that Rasangi said. And on top of that, I'd like to add, it's not only because Mahaprabhu came to the planet that there is some wave of auspiciousness, and no other spiritual teacher or avatar made any contribution except for our God, right? So we want also to acknowledge the teamwork of different faces of the divine and different saints, and again, not fall into any form of exclusivity. And also to acknowledge with empathy, hopefully with compassion, that as exciting as it is of a time to be here on earth, again, at the same time, many terrible, horrible things are happening on earth. And to remain sensitive to those who may be at this precise moment going through some of that. And of course, I mean, I may not tell them this is such an exciting time to come here. I'm so glad you are here, because the person may be experiencing something very sensitive, which doesn't cancel the blessedness of what we are talking about. But again, it somehow includes in its complexity so many other things that also I feel we need to acknowledge and hold, because we may be the ones going through that at times, or if it's not even the case in our case, so many others may be going, are going, I think it's very healthy to balance that joy and celebration with genuine compassion and empathy and connection with people's suffering. Yeah. Just two footnotes. I'm in Harvard, so I'm adding footnotes to everything now. Hopefully it doesn't get worse. Okay, let's move forward to the next raised digital hand, unless there is something urgent that we'd like to be shared from the insights of the sharing groups. So the next digital hand is from Nam Dharma, following the original order. So we invite him to activate, unmute himself. Welcome, Nam Dharma. Pleasure to see you.
Nice to see you. It's been too long. This is sort of like an old growth opportunity issue that has kind of resurfaced from a new angle, and just kind of curious what, that's been a little bit sticky. So I'm curious what you have to say. And, if we have, let's say, there's been a rupture with initiating guru, what I found recently while doing a counseling training, it's kind of like a mindfulness based thing. So the thing that came up was that there is a timelessness in relation to my experience of my relationship with the initiating guru. And also there's a rupture in that relationship, and trying to figure like that's, and but the timelessness part is not ruptured, but there's this other part that's here in kind of more in the, can be in the here and now through this, cycle of living, where there is a rupture. And I'm trying to understand or reconcile those two things. And my experience is that it is totally okay for them to exist concurrently. And also there's like, there's something that doesn't quite resolve within it for me. Like, I think that when I'm in a deeper meditation and prayer, there's a resolution, and also there's some transformation. So I think that's what, that's about what has come up.
Mm. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that, an important topic, a relatable one for sure, and an important, crucial, if not pivotal concern about those two dimensions of the problem, so to say. The timelessness of it and the rupture of it in time. So how to deal with that, how to navigate that, and I can just share my thoughts, of course, and each one has to find their way in their own experience. But I feel that what you've shared so far is very insightful, in one sense, holding as a foundation to the timelessness of it. In other words, the foundation is Guru Tattvas, an eternal truth and reality, that even when the connection with an agent of that department gets disrupted, that doesn't unplug the live wire of shelter and revelation and inspiration and guidance. So that's the timelessness of it, if I am understanding correctly, right? So I think that's the place to go, especially in a moment of rupture. I mean, among other places, of course, peers and brothers and sisters and people with whom to share. But in terms of guru tattva, if I do not feel currently I have one specific individual that I'm relating to officially as a student, if you will, that doesn't mean that guru disappeared altogether. So we can always go, the go-to place as a foundation, not as an excuse, not as a watering down of the principle, on the contrary, as a establishing its proper foundation, is go to the universal principle of Guru Tattva, go to God as the Adi Guru, as the original Guru, go to the timelessness of it, to that reality which doesn't get fractured, disrupted when something happens on this plane in that regard. So I think that's the first step. I'm not saying that's the end of the journey, but that's the first step in terms of wondering, okay, where am I in terms of guru? No, because that's kind of the question also, like, where am I located now? Which is my identity? Which is my role? Which is my belonging? Do I have a guru? Am I a disciple? No, not anymore. I mean, I've asked those questions 16,108 times, and they continue to come. I'm not necessarily yes or no, because at one point it's clear, no, all this remains in place. Then the question starts to be like, okay, how? How I'm connected to guru? How I'm still a disciple? How? And the answer to that how question will mutate so many ways. Not only if you have a problem with your guru, but even if you didn't have any problem with your guru, the answer to those questions, the question should remain there. In which sense I'm a disciple, in which sense I'm a guru, and how I'm supposed to play out this relationship. That should be an ongoing query. So, but for those who have had some type of disruption with a particular, again, agent of the agency of Guru Tattva, first go to the agency, to the timeless agency, Guru Tattva, always available, always 24/7, hotline, live wire, shelter, connection, plug-in connection, if we are willing to be a student ourselves, if we are willing to submit to the truth and to give our hearts to that life, that department will never close our doors. Even if it happened to be the case with some particular agent, with more than one, depending on the case. So that's the first step. And the second step, as you acknowledge, okay, but even in spite of me having done, taking that first step, taking connection and shelter and hope and finding relief in the timelessness of guru in that particular phase of it, still there was a rupture. Still there was a relationship that became affected. Still there was probably trauma. There was probably so many things, no? Suffering. Depending the case, again, I don't want to sound like I'm talking about one case or the other, but depending the cases, there may be feelings of betrayal, feelings of rejection, feelings of, or not feelings even, but literally facts of ostracizing and so many other things, no, depending the case. But at least there will be pain and there will be suffering and there will be loss. And I will say that we should also deal with that. No, we should not just say, I'm going to the timelessness of Guru Tattva, so to say, and that's it. Everything is there. Yes, everything is there, but I may not be able to be fully there if I'm not dealing with my open wound that came as a result of that brokenheartedness of that relationship. So there may be a need to grieve. There may be a need to close that circle, that cycle, to close that particular chapter in a way that is healing. And whatever that may need to be done for that to happen, depending on the case, it may be speaking with the person, if that's not possible, or we are not willing for that for whatever reason, writing a letter without even sending it, or doing a particular ritual, or sharing with, asking for some guidance in that regard, whatever feels natural for our need, so to say. But I think that's important. first of all, as you say, acknowledging there has been a rupture and still something is there, still something feels not fully integrated. So that's something that is begging for attention, begging for wholeness, no, in that direction, for proper integration. Sometimes that takes the form of grieving, no? Grieving what we have lost, and we are doing, if we grieve something we have lost, as we always say, it's because that matters so much to us. There was an important relationship. It was, and that doesn't, it's not limited to a guru, of course. It can be any relationship that for any reason you became distant or disconnected, and but it was an important relationship, it was an important person, it was a person you loved, what to speak, guru-disciple relationship. So lots of important stuff going on in that relationship. So if that becomes interrupted, there's lots of reasons to grieve because there's lots of important stuff that was happening there. But to grieve in a healthy way, not in a depressed way, in a way like, oh, I wish it would have been different, but it's not, and to live in that trap of the of nostalgia or like romanticizing the past and trying to make the present the past. No, also having the courage to accept, okay, it was beautiful. And because it was beautiful, my heart is broken. And because my heart is broken, I need to grieve and to acknowledge the beauty of it. And with that, bring close to the cycle and move forward. And when one does that, and it's not a black and white yes or no, you did it, didn't do it, it's a gradual process. The more we do that, the more we are able, A, to connect more deeply to the timelessness of Guru Tattva, to Guru Tattva, to approach Guru Tattva in a broader and deeper way. But also, if eventually we feel the inspiration and the need to connect to an individual guru figure, more than one, not too limited to one, we will be in a more healthy and healed space to approach the relationship. And of course, part of that grieving process and all that is also analyzing our own role in the relationship, right? Because it's never like, okay, it was 108% fault of the other person, and I'm 108% victim and innocent. And generally never happens that way. I mean, I'm not saying never happens that way, but in general, my point is it's an important time that grieving chapter is also part of an introspection, a time for introspection on how did I approach the relationship? Was I over-idealizing? Was I romanticizing? Was I codependent? Was I expecting something from the teacher that was not to be expected from a spiritual teacher or whatever? So many things in a healthy way, like doing some inventory about where we were, where we are as a student, and from that heartbreak, learning our lessons and integrating them and moving forward to the next chapter. And if at any other moment we happen to be in a relationship or a prospective relationship with the teacher, we are not also becoming utterly cynical, like, oh, again, the same thing will happen all over again forever. But also we are not just rushing in a naive way, with the same immaturities that we had carried in the previous relationship, but hopefully we can learn from that and not be in any rush and take our time and learn and grow and find ourselves in a deeper relationship, whatever that may be, however that may look. So I don't know how that lands on you, Namdharma.
Thank you, Maharaj. I get, there's so much there to consider, to continue to digest. But I think of the grief process that you're framing it in terms of grief as being really useful because while I grieved it, my training as a counselor, like grief is an ongoing process. It's not limited to time necessarily. Can and that. The process of relating to it can take a long time, and it may be that just revisiting it again and again to heal the new layer that comes up and allowing the kind of new measure of grief to be there and processing. And I think when I think of it in that way, it just everything relaxes a bit. It's kind of the sweet spot of I think when we like can sit with grief, it's a very beautiful thing and very profound healing and like so much growth happens. So yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for reminding us about the sweet spot of sitting with grief, which at the same time may be a hot seat. It's not a comfortable one. It requires courage. But again, it's a way of showing how much we care, you know, for what we are grieving about. And I appreciate your point that, or the reminder that grieving is not necessarily a one-time performance, right? It's an ongoing process. So I think it's so important that we get it into our system more and more, this idea that all the things we are talking about, whatever we are talking about, are generally all of them are processes. They are never like one-time acts. I do it, that's it, I'm done. No more need for that. Next chapter. No, you have done it in a certain way, in a certain level, and you can continue doing in deeper and deeper and deeper levels. So it's very important now that we keep this process word. And filter whatever we are doing, filter through those lenses. You put a glass as a process. So whatever you are addressing, a relationship, a grieving, spiritual advancement, the study of a verse, whatever, coming to Harvard, it's a process. It's a process. It's never a dead end. It's never a finished product. So, and again, grieving is a way of acknowledging how much we care, and you can always care more deeply. So therefore, you can always grieve more deeply. If you lost something, you care. So in that sense, grieving becomes a never-ending process in a healthy way. Again, grieving is not like getting depressed. No. It's its own form of, if you want to relate grieving with pain or suffering, but it's a sweet pain or sweet suffering, as we will speak about compassion as suffering, the very word includes the word suffering, passion, but it's a sweet suffering. It's a suffering that enlarges your heart, that brings more empathy, more connection, more sense of interconnectedness and belonging. Still is a form of pain, but it's increasing your love. So grieving could be another way of speaking about something that is paradoxically painful, difficult, and at the same time increasing our capacity for love, our spaciousness internally. So yeah. Thank you. Okay, before moving to the next exploration, let's go a few more minutes, another few minutes, 5 minutes, to explore more about this. Again, whether you had a personal experience with a guide, a guru, or whatever in this connection as we've shared, or you can just change, keep the template, but apply it to any other relationship or situation in which this type of relational dynamics are there as well. So invited to go there to share for a few moments and see you back very soon. Welcome back. Okay. Before going to the next raise digital hand, anything you would like to bring to the table, to the public table, to share with us that was churned into the privacy of your breakout rooms, some breakthrough. Breakdowns, you can keep them private for the group. Breakthroughs you also may keep. Could also keep private, no problem. Okay, we'll keep whatever happened between your hearts. Let's move forward to the next raised hand coming from Hawaii. Chandrika, welcome.
Hari Bol Maharaj, thank you. It's kind of a continuation of the topic because I was, you
Great.
know. This week being Lord Balaram week and considered original guru, I was just wanting to invite you to share some things about Lord Balaram. And since you make everything personal, how our relationship with Lord Balaram can help us in our other relationships and in our bhakti.
Okay. Thank you so much. Sri Balaram Ki Jai. And yes, I wish you all had a blissful, blessed celebration of Sri Baladev Purnim, as we are now gradually warming up for Sri Krishna Janmashtami. There's a celebration season. All seasons are celebratory, of course, but Sri Balaram, yeah, we're talking about guru. We're talking about the timelessness of guru, the samasti guru tattva, the more goddess guru. So there he comes, Sri Baladev. Of course, Krishna himself. There are different ways we can talk about it. If we see our parampara, it all begins with Krishna. So we can say Krishna's original guru, and Baladev is the Vaibhav Prakash of Krishna, the immediate expansion of Bhagavan, therefore it's guru as well. And in one sense, it's more emphasized Balaram as the Adi Guru or Akanda Guru Tattva, this indivisible guru principle, in the sense that Balaram is Krishna, the immediate expansion of Krishna appearing as a topmost servitor. We can talk about so many personalities in that direction. We can bring Sri Radha to the picture and speak about her as the Adi Gurbi. but let's concentrate on Balaram, right? Which is, again, in one sense, is God, is Bhagavan, appearing in this unique form to serve Bhagavan, interestingly. So sometimes, again, devotees will talk in different ways. Sometimes they will say, okay, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, being served, receiving service, being the Vishaya Alambana, using a technical language, or being like the object of everyone else's love and affection. But also we can say Krishna, as we talked in the UK retreat, Bhagavan Bhakta Bhaktimam. No? Bhagavan is the Bhakta of his Bhaktas. God is the devotee of his devotees. So it's not that Krishna is just receiving service and relax drinking a lemonade and not reciprocating at all. On the contrary. So from that perspective, we can also speak about Krishna's guru, a servant. But let's focus on Balaram, which is, of course, again, as I say, the first expansion by Vaibhav Prakash. Very technically, it's explaining Chaitanya Charitamrita by Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami in the chapter dedicated to Nityananda Prabhu, because Nityananda is no other than Baladev, and he's making this very detailed, deep case to explain how all the expansions and different expansions of the divine are emerging from Sri Nityananda, basically, who is not different from Baladev. So Balaram is considered, I mean, we can talk about Balaram from so many perspectives, but I'll try to honor the one that was invoked in connection to the previous topic, which is Baladev as guru. And one of the many ways in which we can speak about Balaram as a guru or as the origin of the guru department, the boss of the agency of the department, is he is Krishna himself expanding in a way that is serving Krishna in basically all the different departments. Santa Dasya, Sakya, Vatsalya, and in nuanced particular way, we could say Madhurya. So in that sense, and this isn't, again, it may sound contradictory, but in that sense, Balaram is guru. For those of us who think of gurus, again, like the idea I say before, we may think of Krishna just receiving service. So we may think, oh, guru is just receiving adoration, receiving service from the disciple. He's the representative of Krishna, and Krishna is just receiving service from everyone. So guru is supposed to do the same. So I may have that gross misunderstanding. But when you understand guru is representative of Krishna, and Krishna is a slave of his slaves, if you want to use Srila Siddha Maharaj's word, a lover of his lovers, a servant of his servants, Krishna is a servant in his utmost abhiman, in his deep core self-identification. He will say, I'm a lover of my lovers. As we were talking in the UK, I remember, we will say, all the qualities of Bhagavan, he can throw all of them out of the window, except for one, which is that quality under which he becomes controlled by the affection of his devotees, and he attempts to reciprocate in kind. So that's who he is, how he sees himself in the deepest core of his being. So that's Krishna, and if the guru is representative of Krishna, the guru is meant to embody all those qualities, to be a servant of everyone. No? Guru is not the master or the owner of the disciple. A disciple will feel completely owned and mastered and conquered by the guru without the guru trying to do so, trying to impose himself, herself for that to be the case, just naturally conquered by love. As Krishna is conquered by the love of his devotees, as Krishna's devotees are conquered by Krishna's love. Everyone, love conquers all. No, it's not a one-way conquest. No, it's not a unidirectional conquest. That it happens in this world, right? Generally, there is the conquistador. You use that word in English, right? It's in a Spanish word. So there is the conquistador, the conqueror, and there is the conquered. The conquered is not conquering. The conqueror, the conquered is not conquering the, I'm getting lost in two words. The one who was conquered is not conquering the conquistador in any way. They become a slave in the worst possible way. And that's why we don't like the word slavery. Even when I say divine slavery, we may feel like some trigger because our experience of that is completely unidirectional and one is exploiting and the other one is completely subservient to that. I mean, exploiting and exploited. But when we are talking in the logic of love, both are conquistador, both are conquered. So love conquers all. Basically, that's the idea. No? So it's a different picture. So Krishna is that, no? Is conquered by the love of his devotees. His devotees are conquered by his love. And is dedicated in service. Baladeva is the immediate expansion of that, representing Guru. And Balaram is serving Krishna in so many ways. Again, in Santa Rasa, as the Sandini Shakti, as the existential department that allows everything to exist, even the so-called inanimate, inert elements. So that's connected to Santa Rasa. Dasya Rasa, Balaram is serving Krishna personally, rendering service, menial service to him. Sakya, in friendship, he's Krishna's brother in the Leela. They are friends. I'm just being very brief in each one of these departments. Vatsalya, Balaram is Doji. He's the elder brother, just 8 days elder, but that's enough for him to deserve the name elder brother. Now, how dare you to speak with me? I'm 8 days older than you. So that's Vatsalya. That's a form of Vatsalya. And then in Madhurya, of course, Balaram being Krishna's brother is not connecting with Krishna romantically, directly. That will be Rasa Abhas. Proper mixing of mellows. But in many ways, we could say he's serving Krishna romantically by facilitating Krishna's romantic pastimes with the gopis and him staying with Krishna's friends, the gopas. And when Krishna's going with some excuse at midday to meet with the gopis at Radhakund, Krishna, Balaram knows all about that, but he turns the eye in another direction. He looks in another direction. No? So that's a way of speaking about that. There's another way of talking about Balaram's Shakti expansion appearing in the Leela Sananga Manjari, another conversation. But the main point is that Baladeva is, again, an expansion of the divine, serving in covering all bases, serving in all these different forms. And that we connect to the principle of Guru. No? I mean, that's one of the ways. That's how I like to do it in this case. So Guru is someone who is an expert servitor. Again, Guru is not an expert conquistador, okay? Guru is not a slave master. Guru is not someone who goes in life trying to own people. Guru is not, I will maybe share more about these days. I was watching today a video, which may not seem very related to the topic, but it's a video about, how do you say in English, plimp? Bhaktirasa knows the word.
Pimp.
No? So different pimps. Pimps are these people who work with prostitutes and they are basically like controlling them in so many ways and manipulating them. These are all people who are an interview with many of them and to see their psychology and the way they think of a woman, which of course is not at all healthy. If not, you will end up working as such. But for me came this idea because there were so many psychological things about exploiting women, controlling them, approaching emotionally broken women and providing, playing the savior card or making them dependent on you and then they have no place to go. And for me, at one point, the whole conversation started to turn into the power dynamics and relationships and time between guru and disciple, and how a guru should not be a disciple pimp, basically. Because it's basically the same card, playing the same card with even more dangerously, because with a whole halo of transcendence. And that power dynamics can happen anywhere else, to be fair, not only here or there. But that's another consideration in this sense. So going back to the point is, yeah, Baladev is guru. Baladev is embodying all these various service disposition, all this, like, how to say, healthy obsession to cover all the bases. Again, not from a place of I have to cover all the bases, I have to be the best, I have to impress Krishna, I have to defeat others, but just because I want to serve the object of my affection in so many different possible ways. And that's what a guru is meant to be doing. Now go back to the figure of a guru. I mean, someone is allowed to have servants only if that person is the topmost servant. If not, it's really dangerous for both sides. If you are not the topmost servant, and you allow yourself to be servant, you enter into the position of the master immediately. Slave owner, pimp, whatever, name it. But if you have been deeply embedded with the spirit of service in, again, all around, pariprajnena, parikram, all in all directions, all angles of vision, then those who come to you as a servant or with a servant disposition, you won't see them in that light. You won't see that, oh, here I have a prospective slave, so to say. Here I have someone who can give me this donation for my agenda. Here I have someone who can make my life easier. Oh, here I have someone who can protect my comfort zone. Here I have someone from whom I can take this advantage. That shouldn't happen. But that won't happen only if you are properly trained in the spirit of a servant. So whomever approaches you, you will see them in terms of you serving them, not them serving you. A genuine guru is never thinking in terms of someone serving them at all. That's the only way you can survive that role. And I'm not saying that to point to those who have not survived the role or have had some difficulties in that, because each case is unique. And we should also have understanding and compassion. But it's important that understand that point. To enter certain shoes, you have to be able to walk your talk, to walk those shoes, not to expect other people to do what you are not willing to do yourself. And that's the healthiest possible pattern, right? So whomever, as I remember once I talked with with Atulananda Maharaj, you may recall he passed away recently. He was one of my Siksha gurus during my first 20 years in Gaudiya Vaishnavism when I was living mostly in South America. And he was very humble person, very beautiful qualities, and one of them was humility. And he told me he had disciples. He told me, every time I see someone coming to me, approaching me to accept me as guru, for me to accept him as disciple, I don't see a prospective student. I see Srila Prabhupada, my own guru, he will say, engaging me further in his service. So the more I ac the, I mean, understand the idea. If I accept that disciple, I'm accepting Srila Prabhupada deeper as my guru and me as a servant of him. Which is in line with the famous lecture that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati gave in his last Vyasa Puja, where he approached all his disciples saying, oh, all of you are my gurus. He started to address each of his disciples as his gurus. And you are protecting me and you are engaging me. And he started to praise each one of his students. You can try to imagine what must have that been for those disciples sitting there and hearing their guardian praising them from a genuine place. Again, not just playing, faking humility for the Vyasa Puja occasion, but genuinely feeling that. And not only saying it once a year for a Vyasa Puja talk, but walking the talk on the daily basis in every moment and relationship. So anyhow, all that to say, Balaram is an embodiment of that, right? In how he's, again, serving in all these directions, all these moods. God himself showing how to serve God, if you will. And therefore, he becomes barely the embodiment of this department, the boss of this department of Guru Tattva, showing what Guru Tattva is all about. So I like to say, to be a guru is to remain a servant from a different seat, but it's to remain a servant. Maybe it's a different seat, it's a different name, it's a different whatever, but the servant part doesn't change. Or if it changes, it changes, you know, in the sense that it gets deeper. It gets more. That's the only way you can, again, navigate those waters with deeper surrender, with deeper prayer, deeper inner life, deeper service disposition. Yeah. So I think that's the way that's one of many ways. Of course, we can talk about Sri Baladev, but because of the question was connected to Guru, and also because I think it's a way to talk about Balaram in ways that are relatable to us. That's why I'm sharing these ideas. No? So we don't just talk about Balaram. I mean, we can tell so many stories and so many leelas and analyze so many technical aspects of Balaram's complexion and this and that, and it's all beautiful. But I think this is one very relatable way to speak about Baladev in ways that not only inform our connection to Guru Tattva, but also inform our own servant orientation, right? And if you are properly oriented as a servant, you are a guru, whether you have initiated disciples or not, like it or not. Like, you are a guru. You are an example of servitorship. That's what it means to be a guru in many ways. There are other elements, of course, but don't take that away, please, from this definition. So anyhow, a few thoughts. I hope that helps, Chandrika.
Thank you, Maharaj. Just right. Thank you.
Thank you for the invitation to share. And we have, let me see the list. We still have two more questions. One from Rohini and one sent by written form by Yugal Kishore. So I will skip this. No, I won't skip. I won't skip this breakout room. Let's go to breakout room one more time, and then I will skip the next one. And we'll try to address the two remaining ones with the time we have. So 5 minutes or so, get together, share deeply if you want, if you like, whatever has touched you about what we have just shared in terms of Baladev, Sri Guru, servitorship, the importance of the relationship with others, not in plain terms, but in terms of servanthood, and so on and so forth. Welcome back. Hope that was some rich journey, further reflection, further perspective, further, ongoing enrichment of our understanding of this perennial truths that can always get more and more enriched and deepened. So that's what we keep drilling and going deep together. One thing is trying to go deep by ourselves, another thing is to go deep together. So before going to the last two remaining questions, anything you would like to share from your last 5 minutes of breakout rooms, something publicly shareable, worthy of being brought to the table, worthy of you stepping outside of the comfort zone and entering the liminal space of activating your microphone, having to say something. Sorry, I'm so cruel. What to do?
I personally think that it is so important to what you said about the guru in connection with Sri Balaram. That because I also made my experiences and the concept that the guru is the servant of his disciples is gives so much, is so relieving to really understand that. And especially if one has met, if I had met my experiences also in a negative way. And this is also about Krishna, about the nature of God, because sometimes one can show God as the supreme authority, the supreme tyrant, or you understand? And Krishna isn't that. He's the lover of his lovers. And this is really, I think this is very crucial in Krishna consciousness to understand and accept that.
Yeah, thank you. And of course, as we're saying, in one sense, the guru is not only the servant of his disciple, but the servant of everyone, because the guru realize he or she has proper insight about God being everywhere, or at least in principle, and they are relating to everyone as they will be relating to God present there with that sense of sacredness and awe and wonder and respect and honor. So not only to his disciples or her disciples, but to everyone. And in connection to the disciples, yeah, probably the guru should be a better servant of the disciples than the disciples of the guru, because you will say the guru is a more trained servant and the disciples are recently arrived servants. So more service is expected from the guru than from the disciple. In the same way that, as I like to say, a guru is someone who has more capacity to learn than the disciples, so the guru therefore will be learning more from the disciple, at least than the disciple from the guru in one point. Not because the disciple is coming, "Hey, learn from me, Gurudev," but because the guru has more capacity to learn, or more capacity to serve, or more capacity to whatever. So that's the if you will, the demand placed upon the guru, in the sense of the same you will say, the same expectation you have upon a parent in relationship to a baby. No, the parents will have to perform certain roles that a baby will be expected to perform in a few decades, but not now. So, and that all, yeah, translates to Krishna again loving us unconditionally before we even acknowledge him, and all the things that are already provided from his side. And we join the party a little later, and we try to reciprocate. But Bhagavan was there present to begin with. So in one sense, the same to the guru being representative of all that, rather than, as you say, projecting some distorted readings of guru or Krishna as tyrant, as master, as slave owner, as dictator, you name it. No, that's our anarthanivritti. We have to purify our filters, assumptions, and resolve trauma. Yeah. Thank you. Katie, you have something you would like to share from the churning rooms?
Yeah, it came up in our breakout room that sometimes a disciple might have a physical 3D association with their guru once or twice or three times in their entire lifetime. And for me, that just brings up the question of, is it just dependent upon each person, whether that person is the disciple or the spiritual master, of, what that relationship looks like, the dynamics in terms of like frequency and, because I could see how some people might want a spiritual master who is maybe a little bit more accessible, without wanting their guru to be their therapist, parent, counselor, but and is that okay? And are there spiritual masters who want that same kind of like more regular communication with their disciples? It's a question that popped into my mind.
I'll briefly say something since it's a question unto itself. And even the word that you mentioned, which is, I have nothing against the word spiritual master, but sometimes the word master is can be taken as, again, the guru is the master of the disciple, right? Like the Lord. It's lording over, you will say. But actually, master has to do that you have mastered yourself, right? You have control your mind, your senses, your stuff is mastered. It's not like I'm here, guys, to master all of you. No, but sometimes these words can be written in that direction. Just footnote, another Harvard footnote to that. But in connection to your question, of course, depends the case. There is no one way it will happen. It should work. But I will say, like, the general ideal template will be that a disciple has some contact with their guru. And again, when I say their guru, I'm speaking in singular, but it could be more than a person, depending on the case. Someone may have, in some cases, you are initiated with someone that for whatever reason you don't have much communication or access to. Generally, it may be interesting and good for that person to have someone which is more accessible as a mentor and guide, and not just someone at my guru with whom I can talk twice per lifetime, so to say. Though with this, I don't want to downplay, I don't know, I know that many of Swami Maharaj Srila Prabhupada disciples never ever met him in person even once. And I'm not saying here they are less of a disciple than those who were more time with him. I'm not saying that. But I'm just saying it also in that case, you have to develop a deep capacity to connect with your guru beyond the physical presence, beyond the physical interaction, beyond the, and even in that case, I will say, and that's for me why it's so important. I mean, when Prabhupada was about to leave this world, and he was asked, okay, you are leaving, to whom shall we go? His disciples asked him for guidance. And he didn't say, you don't need to go to anyone. Everything is in my books, no? Because with all respect, that's kind of the argument that the followers of the Rigvedic system make. But if that will be Prabhupada's intention, at that moment he will say, no, you don't need to go to anyone. You just stay with my books and that's it. But he didn't say that. He mentioned people, so to say, real living sadhus to whom to go and from whom to get guidance, to make the point that's generally very recommended to have someone you can bring your questions again, which doesn't mean to go to the other extreme, because one extreme is you don't have anyone, you just talk to your guru once a lifetime and do not have anyone else. In one way, that's a little bit of an extreme. Another extreme is guru has to be 24/7 available for any single question and thing in your life, and has to be a romantic advisor and financial counselor and psychologist and father, mother figure and husband and wife. No. Balaram can cover all those different rasas, and but we are not gurus, are not Balaram. So there is a certain role for the spiritual master or the spiritual guide or the however we may like to frame it. And of course, there's not only one way of doing it. Some teachers will have a little bit more of time and willingness to accompany disciples in other more in other departments. Some others may not be willing or able. And that doesn't mean they're worse. Again, there is scope for certain diversity in all of that. And one also has to be honest as a student to assess one's inner necessity and to take the time to find whomever we feel will, how to say, properly nourish who we are, where we want to be, no? And not just by peer pressure accept someone as a guru because we were told to, or it's time to, and that's the assigned person for the area, or the one whom everyone is getting initiated from. That's not the criterion for that. So, yeah, that will be it. Short reply because that was not in the list of questions. That was a tricky sneaked in by Katie, but Krishna still loves you unconditionally. No problem. We'll move forward because we have two more, and I want to honor the proper time and finish maximum at the usual time. So we invite Rohini Prabhu to unmute himself, present, bring his offering. Welcome, glad to have you here.
Nice to see you, Maharaj. I don't know if I don't have a comment about what you're talking about
No, but you raised your hand. You had a question, probably.
Early, yeah. It's I just been thinking about people. Okay, so because I'm 80 years old, I can go back 70 years in my life and think about, okay, 70 years ago, I was 10 years old. I can remember all my 10-year-old friends. I've been thinking about all these other people. And it seems like, okay, I can think about them, and that can bring up emotion. It can bring up all kinds of emotion, anger, your heart's broken. And I can also be kind to people. Kindness seems to be a big thing that I can do. But if they've, the people that lived, that I knew 30, 40 years ago, I can't really be, but what for them, I can pray for them. So it seems like it's kind of come down to, I can think about people, I can be kind to people, especially in the here and the now, and I can pray for people. And I was thinking this morning, like, is that it? not that that's nothing, but it seemed kind of profound. Maybe not. I can easily impress myself.
Feel free to impress yourself. Thank you. Thank you for that. And sure, thanks for sharing that. I will definitely not underestimate what you just mentioned. That's not little achievement. That's a lot to take time to think about people. No? And generally, again, the three of them can be connected, right? Because I can think about someone, and you generally don't think about someone neutrally, just like I have a thought, an idea, the person is an idea. I'm thinking about someone with some feeling attached, with some intentionality, and that can in itself can be a prayer or can turn into a prayer. And in one sense, that also is a form of caring for that person. Even if I'm not in front of the person, I will never see that person again in my life. There are so many ways. It reminds me there are so many things could be said about it, and we don't have enough time to honor the question. But recently I was reading a book that was given to me by Manjali. Thank you, Manjali. Beautiful book. The memoir from Professor Francis Clooney, who happens to be my academic advisor during this year at Harvard. And I had a podcast with him. We are friends. And at one point he mentions, when he's 75, he has been recently been 75, but when he was like in his 20s or something, he was on a, how do you say it, subway, and he saw a lady crying deeply, a strange, quote unquote, right? Maybe he was even less than that, 16 years old or something, but he still remembers 60 years after, because that impacted him a lot. But at that age, he was not equipped. He didn't feel like approaching or saying anything. But in one sense, he didn't do anything, but he never forgot her. And he said, I pray for her, and I wonder what must have been her life, how her life might have unfolded, though I will never know. But in one sense, she has been accompanying me till now. No? So in one sense, though in one sense she was a perfect stranger with whom he never had any contact at all, ever. But he witnessed that moment, that stayed with him, that created a deep samskar, and that became a prayer. And not only a momentary prayer, no? But 60 years and counting. And again, I wouldn't say, oh, that doesn't matter. That's not having any effect or whatever. That's not caring enough. Of course, we could make the case, if you care that much for someone that you cross casually on a subway, how much you are invited to care for those who are living with you or under your care, not to impose a demand upon anyone, but just to make the point of, yeah, if we have the potential to care for someone that you just crossed 1 minute on the subway that much, that's a glimpse of potential, right? That shows our caring capacity, how much we can hold someone in our thoughts, in our prayers for a lifetime. So let's not underestimate our potential, our capacities for caring, well-wishing, for praying. And again, it may take different forms. As I say, someone may care externally for someone, but from a place of relative indifference. So to say, oh, I might go in the street, someone is homeless, I give him a sandwich and I continue walking, and after half an hour, I forgot that person, that's it. Okay, it's still something counts of what I gave. But someone else may have witnessed someone crying on the subway. Externally, the person did nothing. Internally, he carried that person forever. So, no. So it's at the end of the day, it's the quality of our presence, of our connection, and what's stirring it in the inside, right? Rather than just external achievement, external shape, the size of the shape, so to say, is the size of the heart. And sometimes we need to make size, we need to make space in our heart, we need to create a spaciousness. So not only we can hold and host enough people in quantity, but also in quality and also in time frames, as the example I just gave. How to hold someone in your heart for so much time in a very beautiful way. No? And detached, because again, the person doesn't know who you are. You don't know who the person is. It's not that the person is paying you a weekly check for you holding them in your thoughts, or they're acknowledging you in any way. No idea. So it's a very selfless action, which is what love is, ideally. No? Love is the zenith of selflessness. I'm doing this for the sake of the beloved. For the well, with the intention of creating the highest possible well-being for the object of my care and affection, not expecting anything in return, but feeling that the chance to do that is in itself the reward, is in itself the treasure. So actually, I don't need to expect anything in return. We need to get to that point of our practice that it's not that we force ourselves not to expect anything in return, but that we feel there is so much coming already from what we have the chance to offer, then there is nothing else to expect in return. There's nothing higher to expect in return. It's not that I'm repressing myself. I shouldn't expect anything in return. I shouldn't expect anything in return. It's that what you're receiving is so rich that there's nothing else to compare with that. So that's in itself the overflowing of the reward. So yeah. And that can take the form of thinking about someone that we crossed 60 years ago, or that we crossed today in the morning, or share a word, or share a prayer. And there is a lot in that, which doesn't mean we cannot do other things. I wouldn't say we cannot do more, as if the other thing will be less, but it can take different forms. And again, if we are honest and sincere and willing to be a servant and a lover, we should trust also the inspiration that will come to offer ourselves in the best capacity at any given moment, whatever form that takes. Sometimes maybe deeply committed action, sometimes maybe a prayer, sometimes maybe holding someone in our thoughts for decades, sometimes maybe a disruption or even a chastisement or a punishment coming from a place of love, because I love that person so much, I need to tell him or her this, which maybe may land as a thunderbolt, but it's really coming from a place of love and it has to take that shape, at least according to how I can assess the situation in my capacities. And God forgive me if I'm wrong with that. So, yeah, can take so many shapes, right? So that's what comes in the little minutes I have left, considering that there's still one more question waiting. So I hope that helped, Rohini Sutta Prabhu.
Good.
Thank you. Good. I have the confirmation mudra. So I'll skip this breakout room, as I mentioned, but keep in mind the topic in case this, because we'll have one closing breakout room in case you would like to explore this direction. We'll go to one question that was sent written form by Yugal Kishore, also known as John. I'll also address it briefly because we don't have much more time. So the question says like this. Let me find it first. Here it is. How can we reconcile, and somehow it's connected, how can we reconcile God's unconditional love with God's necessity to overcome ignorance and evil in seemingly violent ways? Can you put it in the main chat also, Teresa, for whomever would like to read it to follow? How can we reconcile God's unconditional love with God's necessity to overcome ignorance and evil in seemingly violent ways? such as smashing the enemy, for example, Kamsa being smashed by Krishna, or in his descent as the Yuga avatar, who seemingly interferes as a correctional officer. It seems reward and punishment based, and not the relationship of unconditional love. Thank you for sharing, Yugal Kishore. I always love the spice you bring to the table. So, a few thoughts again. It's a topic worthy of exploration, and we've talked about that a few times in the past, I think even in our recent UK retreat. But a few things to say to begin with. Of course, unconditional love, that just as I just mentioned, this example of how our curve will take different shapes. One of them may be at times correction. So unconditional love does not mean unconditional approval. I remember some months ago, that was, I think, the first question presented maybe from Katie, if I'm not mistaken, on this topic. No. Unconditional love does not mean unconditional approval. Doesn't mean anything goes because I love you unconditionally. No, it means even when I have to put conditions, I still regard you unconditionally. And the conditions are invoked, coming out from the unconditionality of my regard to you. Because I love you so much, I'm invoking these particular boundaries for the betterment of all of us. As much as I can feel that's the best thing to do. So unconditional love doesn't mean unconditional approval. Again, divine love, we are speaking here about God. So divine love remains constant, remains a constant in the life of Bhagavan. Even while the divine opposes actions that destroy people, that destroy relationships, or that destroy dharma, going to some of the verses in the scripture. And that's, again, an expression of love. When we say God is love, it's not like just like a fluffy thing. Ah, God is love, la, la, la. Love is not fluffy. No. Love takes endless forms, and many times forms that may not seem as loving as we think love is, because we may have a fluffy idea of love. So sometimes love will mean interruption, boundaries, disruption, correction, punishment, conditions. All of that coming from the source of unconditional love. So Krishna is love. Krishna is not loving, but love. And because he is love, naturally love will take a stance to something that is a threat, that is destroying, that is, as much as it's not canceling other people's free will. No, that's another layer of the conversation that we explore many times. But that's an important point. If I love, if I am God, sorry if it sounds a little bit too narcissistic, it's not about me. I will, because I'm love, because I cannot not love, naturally, the love that I am will take a stance toward the things that go against love in different ways. And when we speak about the destruction of evil, going to the question of Yugal Kishore, the destruction of evil is not necessarily the destruction of the person. Okay? Let's separate two things. He gave the example of Kamsa. First of all, Krishna didn't smash Kamsa. Krishna just scared Kamsa. Interestingly enough, he smashed other people. I'm not denying that. But interestingly, with Kamsa, he just stood like, whoo, and that was enough. He smashed a few others. But the main point here is the destruction of evil, or if you want to speak evil, evil is not an ontological character of the self. It's not intrinsically embedded in anyone. It's just a temporary condition. So the destruction of that temporary condition is a form of love. No, I'm destroying your avidya, your ignorance, your illusion. I'm not destroying the person. Actually, I'm destroying the thing that gets in the way of the person. Right? So, so it's important to understand this. It's a basic point, but in our theology, the jiva is not identical with the asuric condition or the asuric conditioning that one may be embodying temporarily. So Krishna can destroy, let's put it this way, following the example, Krishna can destroy the Kamsa condition while ultimately liberating Kamsa himself. So Kamsa was not destroyed. Kamsa was liberated. No, the Kamsa condition was destroyed. And that's why this, that's why Bhaktivinoda Thakur will speak about all this killing of demons, which externally may sound little violent, as anartha, anartha nibriti, the killing of conditions. Each one of these asuras, whether you read them literally or allegorically, are representing a certain conditioning that it's in ourselves. And Krishna killing them, this is the parallel Bhaktivinoda Thakur made, is Krishna, the name of Krishna, which is none different from Krishna, is purifying our chitta, our consciousness, from all these demons, quote-unquote demons, from all these anarthas, from all these filters. And again, divine punishment, even if you want to use the term, divine punishment, punishment can be understood medicinally, if you will, right? Rather than just as a retributive thing, but as a healing thing, like surgery. Now, surgery, Prabhupada gave that example. No, a doctor may be saving one person's life, but he had to open the person and blood is coming. You can say, wow, that's so violent. And I said, no, no, he's saving the person. So like surgery, God's intervention may appear violent, but the telos, this is an important Greek word, telos is like the intention, the objective it points to, is healing, is liberation, is restoration, is never revenge. Every time Krishna kills someone, all of them get liberated, as we spoke recently. He many times he beheads people with Sudarshan, but Sudarshan means right vision. So he's restoring proper vision. We may need to read many of these sections more allegorically than literally for us to get the main lesson there, the main purpose, and not get stuck in just into the battle dynamics, so to say. And an avatar, or when Krishna himself, the avatari, descends, the purpose of avatar, of course, is multifarious, but one of them is restoring conditions in which love and freedom can flourish. No? So there is a telos, again, a purpose. It's not just killing for the killing's sake or chastising the enemy, and that's the end of the story. Let's not get stuck in that frame of the ever-evolving movie. Now, sometimes you need to clean the soil to uproot some weeds, so to say, so certain things can flourish. Some harvest can be done eventually. So certain ignorance, certain things become deeply oppressive. There is place for divine intervention without canceling free will. And I refer this again and again because it's an ongoing conversation. God has a will, but we also have a will. And if God's will becomes so invasive that our will is totally canceled, then that cancels God's own existence as love, because love has to allow voluntary decisions. So everyone's free will must be kept intact. But God has his free will also. It's not that because we have free will, then Krishna cannot intervene in any way. But that doesn't mean that because Krishna has free will, then we have no free will anymore either. So basically, that's the idea. I know that probably the hardest question is the imagery itself, no? How it may look, what may trigger in us with some associations from traditions or education and violence and blood and beheading and battles. and on top of that, probably a fluffy idea of unconditional love. We may have both of them. When we speak in love about love, we may get too platonic, too fluffy, too sentimental. It can happen. And we go to chastisement and punishment. We go to extreme unresolved trauma places for our being, and both are two sides of the same coin of misperception and distortion, so to say. So based on what we always say about Krishna's being unconditional love, let's conclude saying briefly as a statement, like Krishna's love for Kamsa never ends. No, it never ended, it never started, it was always present. What ended was Kamsa's capacity to continue being Kamsa. The Kamsa consciousness was eradicated. And now Kamsa can become something beyond Kamsa, something beyond the Kamsa box. So that's the actual thing that ended. So there's happy end to the story, or a happy beginning to the actual story now unfolding. So a few thoughts. I hope that helps, and I'm trying to finish on time to be a good boy. And we'll go to one more final breakout room. If you can at least gift us with 5 more minutes, 6 more minutes to conclude our thoughts, and feel free to churn any topics we have shared from this last exploration, the previous exploration, where we share some words regarding Rohini Sutta Prabhu's question, and then see you back for our farewell till next week. Welcome back to you all. Hoping you had nourishing time together again, or time of deep personal reflection. And with that, we put our session to rest after 2 hours thick with nectar and sharing and intimacy. I feel very blessed and very glad to be back with my dear family after 2 weeks, and looking forward to meeting next Saturday. And this Monday, as I told, for those who didn't join the beginning, I will be probably publishing some short video reporting how it has been my first week in Harvard with all the adventures and learning, somehow bringing you all back, bringing you all here with me and accompanying me, and also invoking your blessings and presence on this adventure. And on Wednesday, we have a podcast sharing with Mirabai Star. You will like that one, The God Who Is Love. And if not, we see each other next Saturday. So deep gratitude for your presence, your willingness to show up, to open, to share. Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Hari Naam Sankirtan ki jai, Sadhu Sangha ki jai, Samavida Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Priman Hari Hari Bo, Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha, Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate, Purnasya Purnamadaya, Purnameva Vasishyate.